Okay, good morning, everyone. I'm calling the February 21st Delta Stewardship Council meeting to order. Let's start with establishing a quorum. I'll start with Ken Weinberg to my right.
Weinberg present.
Gatto here.
Debra here.
Fiorini here.
Tatayan here. We have a quorum. We have no closed session this morning, so we'll move right on to the next agenda item, adoption of the January 24, 2019 meeting summary. Council members, we have a revised meeting summary in front of us. Do I have a motion?
No, I'll move for adoption. Or second.
Second.
There's an echo in here.
Meeting summary is adopted. That was fun. Okay, on to the chair's report. Excuse me, let's vote. I'm so eager.
Weinberg, aye.
Gatto, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Tatayan, aye. Now on to the chair's report. I continue to learn from the Stewardship Council staff, high caliber, highly motivated, fire in the belly staff. It's a privilege to be working with these folks. There's a lot going on. I want to highlight one meeting I attended, which is the kickoff meeting of the Social Science Task Force. And I am particularly excited about this task force and the charge of the task force. The charge is to develop a strategic plan to strengthen and integrate social sciences into the science management and policy landscape of the Delta. So I look forward to their set of recommendations. They are to develop a strategic plan within the next 18 months and present the council with a set of recommendations that we can act on. They'll have a technical advisory committee. They'll be advised also by stakeholders, and I really look forward to their product. If you are interested in the details of their charge, go on to our website and search on Social Science Task Force. We have some phenomenal members on that task force. I really look forward to what their recommendations will be. Council members, any other items you'd like to share? Ken?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I just want to point out, maybe ask staff, there was a sort of a commentary from PPIC, and maybe you've already seen this, by Ellen Hannock and Jeff Mount, Delta interests should seize the opportunity to cease water fights. So I think, just saw it on the plane ride up this morning and just seems timely. So I don't know, maybe if the rest of the council may be interested in just to, there's some deep thinkers over there at PPIC.
Great. Thank you, Ken. Anything else to share? Nope. Okay. Well, with that, let's move on to the executive officer's report.
Thank you, and good morning. We're trying something new this month, and we've included an outreach highlights report in your binder. There's also copies available on our website and on the back table. It's really intended to convey to you the council's online outreach efforts for the past month. Gives you an idea of our social media activity, page views of our website, and live viewers of past council meetings, and additional factoids. So if you have any questions about that, please let us know. and we'll start to get a sense of whether this is useful information to include in the packet or not. I'm happy to take any feedback on that going forward. We will not have a presentation today on by the numbers, but we have included it in your packet for your information. For those tracking our Smith Canal Gate Project appeal, this morning we posted our staff draft findings and our hearing notice. We'll hold our final hearing on March 22nd in Stockton at the University Plaza Hotel. We're asking for comments on the staff draft by next Thursday, and the notice includes an email address for comments. A reminder that the council remains under ex parte communication restrictions regarding this matter. For reference in your packet, I've included several Delta Plan implementation and coordination letters, including a letter of support signed by our chair for the National Heritage Area legislation that is active in Washington right now, and Ryan Stambrough will cover that more in detail in his report. The Delta Science Program will be convening in collaboration with the State Water Board a Bay Delta Plan Biological Goals Scientific Advisory Panel presentation on March 4th. The presentation will include recommendations for formulating goals to assess progress towards the Water Board's Bay Delta Plan objectives. So this is an expert panel that we have convened at the Water Board's request, and they'll be presenting their initial findings at the March 4th meeting. More information is available on our website for that, including the charge to the panel and the membership of the panel. As of February 18th, the Department of Water Resources certification for the Winter Island Tidal Habitat Restoration Project was not appealed, and the certification process for this project is now closed. The purpose of that project is to create new tidal habitat at Winter Island by breaching exterior levees and widening an existing channel in order to restore tidal action to the interior of the island. This is one of the Eco Restore projects, which is intended to contribute towards the 8,000-acre tidal habitat restoration obligations that the department has for long-term operations of the State Water Project and the Central Valley Project. And the estimated cost for that project is $8.5 million. We have a couple new hires in our office, and I'm excited to announce a new class of fellows starting in our office. So first with our new hires, Bonnie Dixon is the new information officer with our communications team. I'm not sure if Bonnie is here. There you go. She comes to us from the USGS California Water Science Center, where she had 7 years of science communication experience, and she's going to be focusing on social media and written materials for the council. Morgan Kilgore is a new senior environmental scientist in the science program's communication, synthesis, and decision support unit, and she comes to us from the Gulf of Mexico Fishery Management Council in Florida. There she developed fishery management plans for coral, aquaculture, shrimp, and lobster fisheries of the Gulf. So she's going to be helping us coordinate scientific review and advisory panels, among other activities. Sarah Ward is a new program analyst who's going to be helping out the science program with its contracts and procurement, and she comes to us from the Delta Conservancy. We're also excited to have our new class of Sea Grant fellows in our office starting this month, and I believe they are all here, so I'll have them wave their hand. Kate Mellinson is in the science program Science Communication Synthesis and Decision Support Unit. She received her PhD from UC Santa Cruz, studying the recovery of black abalone in the Northern Channel Islands. Madison Thomas is in the science program's Adaptive Management Unit and will be supporting the Independent Science Board. She has a master's degree from Cal State Long Beach. Corey Flannery recently completed her master's in fisheries biology at Humboldt State and will be assisting with the council's ecosystem amendment and climate change adaptation work. And finally, Tracy Grimes is in the Delta Science Program's Collaborative Science and Peer Review Unit, and she recently completed her master's in ecology at San Diego State and will be working on data synthesis and looking at past scientific review panel recommendations and whether they've been implemented or not. Next, I'm going to turn to Bethany Payne for our legal update.
Thank you, Jessica. Members, I'd like to invite Vera Bezdacek, our new attorney, up to give you a legal update this month. Last month, you may recall that the Delta Water Master let you know that the Bay Delta Plan had been adopted by the Water Board. And this month, we're here to talk to you about the litigation that ensued from that vote. It's relevant to this council, that litigation and the council and the board's vote, because the flows that ultimately become law after all this litigation is ironed out will be used for certifications of consistency with ERP1, with any project proponents that need to certify consistency with that Delta Plan measure. So I'd like to turn it over to Vera to give you an update on that litigation.
Good morning, Chair Tatayan, council members. On December 12, 2018, the State Water Resources Control Board adopted an update to its Bay Delta Water Quality Control Plan for the Lower San Joaquin River and its tributaries, the Stanislaus, Tuolumne, and Merced Rivers and the Southern Delta. The updates will not be effective until after they go through the State Office of Administrative Law and the federal EPA approval process. The updates to the Bay Delta Plan are important, as Bethany mentioned, because ERP1 requires that the Council use the full objectives in the Bay Delta Plan to determine consistency with the Council's Delta Plan. After the updated flows become effective, they will then be used for the consistency determinations. The Bay Delta Plan update sets the flow requirements to 40% of unimpaired flows, which includes improved in-stream flows February through June, the critical months for migrating fish on the Stanislaus, Tuolumne, and Merced Rivers. Several entities have filed lawsuits challenging the update, both on CEQA as well as merits grounds. Some of these entities include the City of Modesto, Modesto Irrigation District, Merced Irrigation District, City and County of San Francisco, the California Farm Bureau, the Pacific Coast Federation Fishermen's Associations, the North Coast Rivers Alliance, and the Winnemem-Wintu Tribe. And depending on the nature of the parties, the position is either that the board has gone too far or it has not gone far enough in its update. The lawsuits are currently in their very initial stages. One of the earliest lawsuits has a case management conference set for May 2019. Many of the litigants are also parties to the voluntary settlement agreements with the State Water Board, which were in negotiations at the time that the board adopted its update. It's anticipated that at least some of the litigants will continue to negotiate voluntary settlement agreements while the litigation is pending. Those parties are asking the Water Board to consider scheduled pulse flows and habitat restoration to address both environmental and water reliability concerns. If agreements are reached after the updates are in effect, then the Board would consider them as potential means for implementation of the Bay Delta Plan updates. The settlement agreements would undergo additional public process as well as CEQA review. This update is phase one of the Bay Delta Plan update. There will be a phase two, which is currently in progress, that will be for the Sacramento River and its tributaries, and the Delta and its tributaries, which include the Feather, Yuba, and American Rivers. The goal for the board is to have comprehensive amendments to the Bay Delta Plan across the watershed presented to the board for consideration as early as possible after December 1st of 2019. We will continue to monitor key developments and the litigation, including if there is any consolidation or coordination of cases, and we'll update you with information as it becomes available. And this concludes my presentation, and I welcome any questions you may have.
Thank you, Vera. Council members, any questions for Vera? Ken?
No. Great report. It's a real interesting thing that we've got to monitor, but the basis for the claims, you know, what is it process? I'm not sure what you challenge the state board when they set, you know, flows and water quality requirements.
They challenged the CEQA process, and some of the claims are based on Port of Colon considerations and constitutional requirements for reasonable use.
Councilmember Weinberg, a large part of the attack is on the 40% unimpaired flow. So the big issue on CEQA and on the merits will be, as Jessica and I were talking about earlier, on the role of science and how the court looks at the environmental analysis. And then, of course, you have the voluntary settlement agreements that are pursuing an alternative approach with the pulse flows as an alternative to that 40% number.
So the water boards require, because Porter Cologne is the claim that they're not upholding Porter Cologne, or that there's some part of Porter Cologne that they can challenge, you know, the setting of the flows.
Right, and there's, as Vera mentioned, there are a lot of different cases, so we're watching to see how all the variety of claims shake out once those cases are coordinated and consolidated, what injunction requests we might see, and it's still early enough days that the details are still going to be ironed out, but that 40% number is going to be the big target.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Vera.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to invite Ryan Stambrough up for our legislative report.
Thank you, Jessica. Good morning, Chair Tatian and council members. Tomorrow marks the bill introduction deadline for the legislature. To date, a little over 1,100 bills have been introduced, a few of which I'd like to highlight this morning. However, first I'd like to draw your attention to your binders, where you'll find the council's current legislative policy, which I thought may be a helpful reference, particularly as the session ramps up. Happy to answer any questions should the council have that. The first bill I'd like to discuss this morning is AB 409 by Assemblymember Monique Lamone from Santa Barbara, which would establish a grant program within the Office of Planning and Research focused on supporting climate adaptation planning in the agricultural sector. In addition to requiring grant applications to be based on the best available science, this $2 million grant program would prioritize projects that are collaborative in nature and include a cross-section of interests such as farmers, ranchers, technical experts, and individuals from socially disadvantaged communities. Given the bill's emphasis on assessing the agricultural sector's exposure to climate change as a means to informing adaptation strategies, I believe the general concept of this bill aligns well with the council's current work on the climate vulnerability assessment, which I know you'll hear a little bit more about later today, but particularly as it relates to the agricultural sector and the fact that farming continues to make up the predominant land use in the Delta. Moving on to SB 204 by Senator Bill Dodd from the 3rd District that encompasses much of the Delta, and the matter of legislative oversight pertaining to contracts for the State Water Project and for WaterFix or its successor. Specifically, this measure would augment the legislature's scope of review by adding WaterFix-related contracts to the legislature's purview, and additional compliance criteria for long-term water supply contracts, which are currently subject to legislative review. One thing to note, however, is that SB 204 does not appear at this time to provide the legislature with approval authority over either contract type. And then the last bill I'd like to touch on this morning is SB 226 by Senator Jim Nielsen from Gerber, so up north in the state, which would establish a watershed restoration grant program for private landowners. As written, the bill defines watershed as a body of water that has been affected by wildfire prior to December 2019 and would require grant applicants to submit a yet-to-be-defined watershed management plan that would be subject ultimately to resources agency approval. While the bill is obviously still in its infancy in terms of development, incentivizing restoration on private lands could help address what has historically been a significant challenge to restoration should it work its way down in through the Delta. All three bills will likely be heard in their first policy committees in March, And then briefly, I'd like to note before moving on, in related news, Governor Newsom signed his first piece of legislation earlier this month. This was AB 72, which provided $131 million in emergency relief funds, including funding for safe drinking water in the Central Valley, which is certainly a key key priority for this administration. And then finally, as Executive Officer Pearson noted, I'd like to note that the potential designation of the Delta as a National Heritage Area has gained momentum in the recent weeks, with the designation provision recently being added as a rider to a broader natural resources package authored by Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska that passed out of the Senate last week on a vote of 92-8. As the council will recall, not only is the NHA designation a key recommendation in the Delta plan, but something the council has historically supported this effort through previous letters, as well as modest financial support for some of the groundwork that has been done by the Delta Protection Commission on this end. To that end, a letter of support signed by the chair, Tatayan, and included in the council materials was sent yesterday to Senator Feinstein and Congressman Garamendi. And with that, Madam Chair, that concludes my report. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ryan. Any questions for Ryan, council members? Judge.
I just have a general comment. Is there a way you can highlight in order of what you consider to be very important legislation that we would just read at the top of the list as opposed to sequentially the actual introduction of bills? I mean, I know that you included the body of the text of the legislation and those two items, three items, I guess. But I'm talking about just as part of the laundry list of key bills that you think are important that we should have focus on. Can you somehow separate that out from the?
I certainly can. I'd welcome an opportunity to discuss it with you maybe in a little bit more detail offline as to what specifically you're looking at. But if it's simply kind of along the lines of a priority list of kind of top five, top seven, something along those lines, I can certainly do that going forward.
Okay, that's kind of what I had in mind.
Okay.
But, many other council members have different thought, but I think it would be good for us anyway to see what you think to be the more important bills.
Certainly.
Ken?
Just maybe a question for Supervisor Villegas, who CC'd on the letter of support. Has this been a long-term goal of the Delta counties and the to achieve this, or is this something that, you know, has been, you know, a priority for your county and other counties?
Well, I can speak to the more recent actions that the Delta Protection Commission has taken, but in terms of a longer-term goal, Eric Vink from the Delta Protection Commission is here, and he can speak to that if you're looking for it, but it's risen to the level of a priority now that it appears to be gaining traction. I don't know if Eric or how much more, but my recent term on the Delta Protection Commission, it does appear to rise pretty quickly to the level of a priority in terms of, it's consistent with the other priorities that
I can hold the question. I know Eric's on the agenda later.
All right.
I can hold that. Thank you. Just one quick question for Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
On 226, just so I know, I think it was a couple years ago, the big fire in Yosemite in San Francisco was very concerned about water quality impacts and really kind of went on a crusade to raise the visibility of this issue. So are we looking at from, you know, these fires over the last year, water quality impacts to the Delta, is that becoming an issue of concern, the, you know, organic material? And
yeah, so one of the things that was established as a result of the campfire was a watershed emergency response team. And this included representatives from CAL FIRE, DWR, the State Board, USGS, and a few others. And really, They issued a final report at the end of last year, and what the major focus on for this for the response team was focused on impacts associated to that fire-related impacts associated with property loss and life loss, so floods, landslides, those likes. They note in the report why the scope of this report was not intended to look at ecosystem impacts, water quality impacts, and the like. They do feel that the information that they use to assess life and property loss could be utilized for a more detailed assessment on that end. I certainly think it's something that is not lost on the agencies, but the extent to which that is currently being assessed, I think that remains to be seen. However, moving forward, obviously we know with climate change that this continues to wildfires are only going to increase. So I certainly think it's a focus for the state as a whole.
Okay. So something we should probably keep our eye on. And thanks.
Thank you, Ryan.
Okay. Moving on to sub-item C, last month you requested a presentation of the council's annual budget. So here today to do so are Deputy for Administration Mary Ray and our Chief Deputy Jessica Law. Also included in your binder is an updated org chart that we have updated as recently as this morning. Mary?
Good morning. Chair Tatayan, members of the council. My name is Mary Ray, and I'm the Deputy Executive Officer for Administration. And here today, to present a brief overview of the summary of our 18-19 operating budget. You're probably familiar with this next chart. This is intended to be a representation of the governor's proposed budget. The actual proposed budget is included in your package. You can read that. This is just an eye chart. I'd like to make, many of you may be familiar with the format, but I'd like to make just a few comments about it. This proposed budget is released January 10th and is referred to commonly as the GALLI. It is a planning document for the 19-20 budget year and represents the proposed budget at this point in time. It's done at a very high level and has 3 years presented. The first year is, in this case, the 17-18, which is our actual budget expenditures for the prior year, 18-19, which is our current budget year, and the 19-20 proposed budget. What I just wanted to mention is that the state does not do a zero-based budget. Rather, what we do is a incremental budget, also called a program budget, meaning that the baseline is established at a certain level of support for your program and then can only be changed by the approval of either a budget change proposal, known as a BCP, you'll hear it referred to as a BCP, or a baseline budget adjustment, and a baseline budget adjustment is made by the Department of Finance, and generally for things like increases, salary increases, or retirement, or benefit rates, something like that. So that's a segue to the next slide. Want to talk a little bit about the budget development process. Many of you are probably familiar with this, so I don't want to really belabor it, but there are some important notes, and since we're starting off at the beginning of the year, it's probably easiest to read from left to right, and tell you that the governor releases his budget on January 10th. It's the proposed budget for the next year. During spring, the Assembly and Senate schedule hearings on the proposed budget. By the 14th of May, the Department of Finance releases the revised budget proposal, known as the May Revise. And by June, the legislature must send the budget bill to the governor. Then that begins July is the beginning of the new budget year. and immediately budget letter of instructions go out to the departments, and we begin the budget cycle again. So during the fall and into early winter, budget change proposals are prepared, and they are discussed and reviewed with the Department of Finance, and then presented to the governor, and those that are accepted are included in the proposed budget for the following year. So Delta Stewardship Council has been successful in the recent history achieving a couple of these BCPs. Because we're always preparing for the budget a year in advance, in December of 2015, a BCP was prepared and submitted to provide high-priority Delta Plan updates and critical science investigations, and that BCP was approved, and that provided $1.45 million in each of two subsequent fiscal years. I don't know if you can see that. So that high-priority Delta Plan updates, $1.45 million for 16-17 and 17-18. Thank you.
And not to interrupt, but so that would cover the conveyance storage operations amendment, the ecosystem amendment, and the Delta levies amendment.
Absolutely, and performance measures amendment, exactly. So that was approved for those 2 years, and in addition, $2.1 million of general fund was approved in an ongoing basis for critical science investigations, and that's to inform water and environmental management in the Delta under the Water Code 8520B4 in order to further the science action agenda. This funding, you'll note, is ongoing, so that actually did adjust our baseline budget. In August of 2017, we submitted a BCP for the 18-19 budget year, and that was, we were able to obtain $2 million for one-time funding from the ELPF fund, that's the Environmental License Plate Fund, and that $2 million was, again, to provide funding for critical science and is being used for the source of funding for the Joint Proposal Solicitation Notice, the PSN, with Fish and Wildlife. The PSN is the result of a collaborative process that demonstrates coordination with other agencies, leverages funding by combining it with other funding, bond funding, and other federal funds, and provides a basis for consistent science through an efficient process for applicants and reviewers. So that was a pretty major accomplishment. That BCP also funded three positions that were previously limited term in nature and were being used for adaptive management, and that was paid for by DWR. And so that also added, is ongoing. I don't know if I can get in the way there. That's ongoing funding, changing our baseline, as well as the senior legal counsel that was requested in order to handle the contracting for that significant amount of work. So to recap and do a summary, primarily the Delta Stewardship Council is funded by two sources: general fund, which provides about 87% of the funds, and ELPF, which is unnamed for some reason up there, but that's the ELPF that provides. In the current year, about 13% of the funding. As I mentioned, the ELPF includes that one-time $2 million increase. So when that is removed from the baseline, we'll go down to about $880,000 on an ongoing basis. And that money, so those were the sources, ELPF and general fund. The uses of those funds, in the ELPF, you can see that the big slug is that $2 million approved from the BCP. That funding is also used to fund the positions of the council and the legislative and policy advisor, as well as your attendant expenses like travel and operating supplies, office supplies. The general fund money, these are the uses displayed in a pie chart for the general fund money. We receive approximately $18.8 million. The biggest chunk is used for the other salaries and benefits of the other staff that include science and planning, executive and administration, IT. And that's in total of the remaining staff. Operating expenses make up about 16% of the budget, $3 million in this year, and include all of our general overhead expenses like rent, telephone, IT licensing, maintenance, office supplies, travel, conferences, and our support to other state agencies like CNRA, not to give you the full alphabet soup, but DGS and Office of Technology and our State Controller's Office, SCO, and Cal Fire and Cal HR and CNRA, if I didn't already mention them. Our executive and professional services are about 8%, about $1.6 million, and that's primarily provides for outside consulting assistance for communications, trainings, CEQA litigation or support from the AG's office as needed. That leaves approximately 30% of the budget, or just over $5 million for Delta Science Program and planning. The Delta Science Program, I'm sorry that number didn't appear, but it's $4.45 million, which is 24% in the current year, and planning is at $900,000, and that's about 5%, so that makes up about the 30%. That includes, in science, the core science activities, like ISB and peer review workshops and the Bay Delta Science Conference, and again, the critical science investigations that will be going through the PSN process, and then that's actually in evaluation right now, and we'll be coming back to the council for approval contracts in April, I believe. And then planning is allocated approximately $900,000 annually. Funding is prioritized based on the requirements in the Delta Reform Act. And examples of projects from this source include climate vulnerability assessment, Delta 5-year plan review, and other council priorities. So that's a quick overview of our budget. If you have any questions.
So Mary, just so you know, the numbers are in our handout, so they're there. Yeah.
Sometimes you move from formatting one computer to the other. And
right. Yeah.
Life gives you lemonade, yeah. Or lemons.
Council members, any questions for Mary?
Thank you. It was very, sheds lights on a lot of. One question that I had, are these standalone projects, let's say, that are in 1 year that carry to the next year, and when that happens, the budget goes through with that, or how do you account for those that cut across, let's say, two fiscal years?
Right. So there can be multi-year projects, and funding can be allocated in the current year with the intent of funding additionally in the second year, but that's always subject to approval in the governor's budget. But that's why they've used that program budget. So if you have $5 million, it's reasonable to assume that, you know, you have a stable base of another $5 million in the next year, unless something drastic happens.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Ken?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I had asked staff to come back with this just because how the state budgets is a little bit of a mystery to me, and what our budget is, and kind of looking at attachment one to item 7C in our binder is for 2019-2020 is $26.8 million. Is that the total budget for the council? And I'm used to seeing things as, you know, personnel related and non-personnel. And so, you know, if we were to see, you know, how much is it? Well, the first question is that how I should read our total budget? Or is this only, is that attached?
So he's talking, he's talking about the galley.
Oh, okay, great. Sorry, I didn't,
okay,
I don't have the package.
I learned a new term, a galley.
The galley, right. So the we have approval for in eight, wrong galley. That's better. In the 1920 year, $26 million. You'll see that the next line underneath that, if you're reading from the three-year expenditures and positions, includes four funding sources, general fund and the license plate fund.
Right.
Those are really cash that would be approved. If you look at the federal trust fund and reimbursements, those are limits. That's not cash that comes to us. Those are limits that we cannot exceed.
So those are it's called reimbursable authority.
Right.
So, for example, when the State Water Board contracts with us to put together an expert panel to establish biological goals for their water plan, we have a ceiling of how many of those either federal or state contract dollars we can receive.
Okay, so maybe we can come back to that just to kind of get an understanding that other state agencies pay us to do things, and we pay other state agencies to do things. And,
right.
And that's right. So, you know, maybe on just for an understanding of the order of magnitude of our non-personnel, which would be all of what I would call, I'm going to use different terminology, so if you don't know what I'm doing, but what I would call professional services. So all the, you know, we get the quarterly, I think it's a quarterly report,
right,
on contracts. So we have professional services or non-personnel expenses.
Mm-hmm.
How much of our budget is that? I mean, I think I'm at this level. I mean, I don't want to drill down. I don't want to know everything there is to know about state budgeting, but how much of our budget is personnel and how much is sort of this professional services and non-personnel?
Good question. So if you look at the next category on the second page or the next presentation, it's expenditures by category. And there you can see personnel services is the first line item. Pardon me? Personal services. And then you can see operating expenses and equipment. So personal services includes all of our labor and staff benefits, and then you get down to the operating expenses, and contracts are included in there.
So if I read this, our total what I call personnel, but you're calling personal services,
yeah.
So that's our positions
staff.
And staff, that's $9.6 million, so the balance of $15 million is, or
17,
is this operating expenses, and some of that is keeping the lights on,
right,
and equipment and that kind of thing. How much of that 17 million is kind of this professional services or you know, like the science program, is the labor in the science program is
no.
in that 9.6 million?
Correct.
So how I guess I'm trying to understand, you know, how much is our professional services, where we're either contracting with another state agency or we're bringing consultants in, just so we have an understanding of,
so,
you know, how, which is the majority of what our budget is.
Councilmember Morenberg, I think I can answer that. If we can go back to the pie chart that Mary had in the presentation, and if we look at the general fund, I think it's the last slide that's on there, so you've got it in your handout. The pie chart shows salary and benefits. So this is, the general fund is really the majority of the funding that we have for the council. So if you,
Jessica, could you say what page on the
last page?
Slide seven.
Thank you. Yep. So if you look at that, you can see salary and benefits. Operating expenses is really indirect expenses. That's not including consultant services. The Delta Science program, so the value there is $4.45 million. Planning is $900,000. and executive professional services is 1.6. And if my quick math is correct, it's about $7 million that we have every year for consultant services.
Okay, so labor is not in these numbers.
Labor's in the salary and benefits.
Okay.
The bottom half of the
pie chart. These slides 6 and 7 are non-personnel expenses, what I call non-personnel expenses.
So the salary and benefits is personnel expenses.
Right.
So is
that's
9.6
million.
So yes, so the 8.858 million on this general fund slide, that goes to pay the salaries of all the staff at the Delta Stewardship
right.
Council, excluding the council members. The majority, the council member salary and the legislative analyst salary come from the ELPF fund.
Ken, flip your chart over. That's the page they're talking about.
No, I know. But I was just looking at, you know, these are by funding source, so the, you know, is if there's no labor in slide 6 and 7, so is that our combined sort of study or professional services budget?
The labor is indicated by the portion of the pie chart that shows salary and benefits.
Right here. So that's
okay,
47%.
No, for 6 and 7, 6 and 7 look to me like those are sources of funds. And expenditures. So, you know, I guess, you know, maybe my ask here is just, and I don't want to, you know, you guys have a really detailed handle on this. I just want to have an understanding, and I think maybe it'd be helpful to the rest of the council is, you know, what is our budget for all the work that we contract out for?
It's about $7 million per year.
Okay, so out of that, roughly the 17 million that's non-personnel, 7 million of that is what we get for professional services or the science program is going out for, or some of that may be reimbursable from other state agencies. Is that correct? That
yes.
Part of that 7 million. So 10 million is for, you know, non-professional services. That's for overhead and paying other state agencies for services,
yeah.
Or is that?
There's about 8.9, let's say 9 million for salaries and benefits.
Right.
About 7. Ken, you're making me do math online.
I'm sorry. Okay.
And then another 3 million for just operating expenses, our rent, keeping the lights on, phones, laptops, all that sorts of thing.
You know, I think that would be that kind of high level breakdown, and
then so that's about 19.
We know when we see the quarterly reports, we understand. Gee, this is a big is a big part of our budget, and we understand that. And so, okay, last point that, you know, I want to explore a little bit, just or to understand a little bit more, is these relationships with other state agencies. So is that, you know, whether money's going out or whether money's coming in, that's all reflected in our $10 million a year budget amount.
Well, if you're talking about reimbursable, that would only be the money that's coming in from other agencies.
But if we're doing work for other
agencies, it's rarely that much. It's generally a fraction of that.
Okay. So if we contract with other state agencies for work, that and you know, one just from my experience, we used to try and leverage as much funding as we could, you know, by matching or jumping on somebody else's, you know, works and maybe expanding, you know, the scope of that work. Is that so you know, maybe this question is, does that, are we at like 7 to 10 million a year that we're spending on whatever these services are, or, you know, is that part of a bigger amount of work that's going on out there that we're getting, that we're leveraging our money? Are we getting more
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, in fact, I'm, as Bethany just mentioned, part of the reason why our lead scientist isn't here today is because he's busily reviewing all of the applications for the large, you know, pot of science contracts and grants for research that the council has partnered with both Fish and Wildlife and the Bureau of Reclamation on in order to pull a large pot of money together and have a competitive solicitation.
Okay.
So that's probably the most relevant and largest example of how we're doing that now.
One other point of clarification on that, and this goes back to our operating expenses. We're a fairly small state agency, and so we contract with other state agencies for services like HR and accounting and general services. So that's, if you looked at all the other contracts that we had with state agencies, that's probably the majority of what that where those go. And then you'll see in the quarterly contract report, occasionally we do, so beyond science funding and leveraging science funding, the planning division often works with the Delta Conservancy or the Delta Protection Commission to help leverage some of the funds that they have for Delta-specific projects. And then in the case of last year, we worked with three or four other agencies to help leverage funding and work with the State Coastal Commission to support sustainable conservation, which is a group that's working on statewide permitting. So, and that's something that was coming out of DPIC as a priority action. So we do look for opportunities to leverage our funds as much as we possibly can.
Okay. No, that's really good to know. It's very helpful. I guess where I'm going is that just trying to get an understanding for the council of, you know, based on what our priorities are and what we want to accomplish, you know, what kind of budget are we working with, and then just trying to understand that. The last question is, I noticed, I think it was between 2017 and 18, we went down from 63 total positions to 59.7 positions. So is that, was that a reflection of...
I can try to explain that. What that is...
Because you're very busy. I would think you'd want to hold on to all your positions.
We there is adjustments made. Our actual authority is for 70 positions, but 63 is the net of the transparency calculation that is made for vacancies. So you'll never see the 70 appear because it's always adjusted for anticipated vacancies.
Oh, okay.
And we actually added a position last year in the last BCP.
Okay. No, that helps. I didn't realize that. Okay. Thank you. Great presentation. Really helpful. I hope this was helpful to the rest of the council.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your hard work on the summaries.
Great. Great discussion. Okay. Next up, without further ado, I'd like to invite the Executive Officer of the Delta Conservancy, Campbell Ingram, to the table. And Eric Vink, Delta Protection Commission.
Good morning. If it's okay, we thought Eric might go first because he has a great diagram that kind of talks about how the trilogy works together.
So. Yeah, which is now on the screen. So, Chair Tatayan, council members, glad to be here this morning and join you. Very briefly, the commission was formed in 1992 legislation, actually by your former colleague, Patrick Johnston, his legislation, largely over concern about urbanization at the periphery of the Delta. And I'll talk about one of our actions related to that issue, but this was the only state agency for the Delta when it was formed in 1992. Of course, the world changed in 2009. This slide here is just an attempt, and it's really more our view of the world, which I think is largely accurate, but our view of the world of Delta agencies and what our specific activities are without being comprehensive, and more importantly, where there's overlap between our respective agencies. And of course, at the very center of that diagram is the co-equal goals, which we are all trying to accomplish. I'm just going to hit a few very small highlights of what we're doing currently, but I wanted to start with this because for me it's always a good reminder about where we share activities with our fellow agencies. And we have very specific responsibilities that we work closely with the Conservancy on, likewise with the Council. Our commission, in the 2009 legislation that created your council, our commission was reorganized. It had prior to that been largely a state, a true state agency, and that most of the commission members were representatives of state agencies. Since 2009, we are very much a locally led commission. 11 of our 15 commission members are local officials from the Delta region. 5 county supervisors, 3 city council members, and 3 reclamation district trustees serve on our commission in addition to representatives from 4 state agencies. So some of you might wonder why the commission takes the positions it does, and I think that largely explains it. We are really a locally led state agency. Our chair is always a rotation amongst our 5 county supervisor members. Chair Villegas, your colleague, Council Member Villegas, is our current chair. But that explains a little bit about why we are organized the way we are and take the roles we do. Since 2009, I would contend that the commission's most important activity is advising your council on how to best protect and enhance the unique Delta values, agriculture, recreation, culture, and natural resources. In addition to that statutorily mandated activity, we also have other requirements from the statute, some of them going back to the original legislation. One of those is to prepare and maintain what we call a land use and resource management plan for the primary zone of the Delta. The 1992 Delta Protection Act took the legal Delta boundary and it carved it into a primary zone, which is the majority of the Delta landscape, largely rural, actually almost entirely rural, almost entirely agricultural. The primary zone does not include any incorporated jurisdictions in the Delta. The cities in the Delta are all located within the secondary zone. And your former colleague, Patrick Johnston, could tell you a lot of stories about how those lines were drawn and the trade-offs that were made in the legislation. But suffice it to say, our plan for the primary zone of the Delta is really an overlay over the largely agricultural, almost entirely rural part of the Delta. It does include those historic Delta communities, most of them located along the Sacramento River, Cortland, Walnut Grove, Clarksburg, those communities. So our plan restricts local government land use decisions in the primary zone of the Delta. It was first adopted in 1994. It was updated in 2010, and we're in the process of updating it contemporary with the world that now exists since 2010. We're probably a few months away from bringing that to our commission for consideration. We've done a lot of background work in small meetings with different stakeholder interests throughout the Delta region. We're now opening that up to broader public meetings. We just had our second of those last evening. We'll have our concluding one next week. Our commission meets every other month, whether it's in unlikely in March, probably more likely in May. We'll bring that to them in a draft form, get direction from them, and then go forward from there. So that's our land use and resource management plan. A lot of work has gone into that. I did want to give you a quick update on that. The second thing that we're currently embarked on, and it's very relevant to the council, is In the 2009 legislation, the commission was directed to prepare an economic sustainability plan for the Delta that took a deep dive looking at the Delta economy. And it was intended to help inform a series of recommendations to the council for inclusion within the Delta plan. That series of recommendations was presented to the council in 2012. Some of them were incorporated into the Delta plan. Some of them were deferred because they had to do with what at that time was the Bay Delta Conservation Plan, and some of them were rejected. But all of this flowed out of the economic sustainability plan mandated by statute. The statute also mandated the commission, much like it does the council, to review and update that economic sustainability plan. And so we were unsuccessful in securing funding. We're a very small agency compared to the Delta Stewardship Council. There's 8 full-time employees at the commission. So we needed a special augmentation to be able to do an overall update of the economic sustainability plan. We were unsuccessful trying to secure that so that we could update the plan as mandated in the year 2016. We were more successful in subsequent budget years in obtaining little segments of funding. And so we're largely completed with updating the agricultural section of the ESP. And we're embarking on an update of the recreation and tourism section of the ESP at present. Those are the two largest components of the Delta economy, and that's why we took them in that order. So we're well along with agricultural update. We're just at the beginning phases of the recreation and tourism update. The intention is that that will refresh what's in the 2012 plan, and our intention is to bring a revised set of recommendations to the council for consideration and incorporation into the Delta plan. Again, that's really our primary and important role, is to advise the council on how best to protect and enhance the unique Delta values. Completely unrelated to that, I wanted to answer the question from Council Member Weinberg about the National Heritage Area. We're very thrilled with the progress the legislation is making in this session of Congress. The Delta counties have been supportive of the National Heritage Area. I don't know that we have current support letters for the legislation that's in this session of Congress, but it's practically identical to the legislation introduced in each of the 5 previous sessions of Congress, so we hope the 6th time is the charm. I know that the authors have requested support from the Delta Counties Coalition. I believe that that has been provided, and I just don't know what the status is of individual support letters from the counties. But we've always had good support from the Delta counties for the NHA proposal. Anyway, I ranged rather widely, but that's an update I wanted to provide, and I'm happy to answer any questions or clarify anything.
Any questions for Eric from the council? Campbell. Ken, I didn't see.
You have a question for Eric?
No, I do not. I was helping them recognize your question.
Eric, just maybe you can, the land use plan, my understanding is it's not a covered action. You're probably not doing CEQA because it's a plan.
We'll do a CEQA equivalent.
Okay. Oh, so you will
and
do
I,
like a programmatic.
I think we do consider it to be a covered action. I mean, we're going to work closely with the council staff, but our intention is that it's going to be consistent with the Delta plan.
Yeah, that was my question, because, you know, one of the things that we're working on is the ecosystem restoration amendment, and we're focusing a lot on, you know, sea level rise and climate change, and just wondering, you know, and I know this is a draft, but, you know, how is the Protection Commission going to, you know, or what are the thoughts of the Protection Commission in addressing that? You know, I think
since we're developing the amendment, it'd be helpful to all of us to, you know, how can we work together and align, you know, ourselves?
Well, specific to climate change and sea level rise, I really don't see that impacting the update of the land use plan much. I mean, the land use plan really, the first commandment of our land use plan is thou shalt remain agricultural. And that's certainly consistent with any response to, you know, long-term planning for sea level rise, climate change, or sea level rise. So the land use, and I didn't do a real adequate job of explaining the whole purpose of the land use plan. I hope I said that it only applies to local governments within the primary zone. And, of course, the local governments within the primary zone are the five Delta counties. So it's a plan that provides guidance to the counties in terms of how they do their local land use planning for the Delta region of their respective counties. And, of course, local governments are required to address climate change and in their general plan efforts. And so I know that we will be referencing it. It came up in one of the meetings. We're talking about how to at least incorporate some reference to that in the plan, but I don't really see it changing policies or goals or the overall direction where we head with the land use plan.
Okay.
I had a question, if possible. I just wanted to know, when you were defining the methodology used or the criteria used in defining the boundaries of it, and mostly, in my understanding, it is something in protection of a certain area, correct? I mean, that's why we designate it as a heritage area. And if so, I just wanted to understand that, and then I also wanted to understand the criteria used and the process that went through defining the boundaries.
Specifically the boundaries for the heritage area, right, or the primary zone, secondary zone boundaries?
Just the heritage area.
Yeah. It's actually a curious boundary because it's a little more expansive than the legal delta. So it runs a little bit up north through the Olo Bypass. It also incorporates the Carquinez Strait, which goes outside of the legal delta. So the Sassoon Marsh, part of your legal delta, not part of our legal delta. But the Carquinez Strait is outside of both. So, and then at the same time, it excludes areas largely east of Interstate 5 near Stockton.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this question yesterday. I don't have the answer yet. I don't know why that boundary was originally established to exclude Stockton. Mm-hmm. There's certainly a lot of Delta culture and history in Stockton, and that's the whole purpose behind a National Heritage Area, is to celebrate those type of things. I can tell you the boundary was enlarged outside of the Delta to include the Carquinez Strait because there is a lot of Delta-related culture and history that goes along with that region as well. It's just for the purposes when the legal delta boundary was established, that area was not included. Mm. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, but my concern more than that is that when we do this, if there's not a very specific methodology, how does somebody get included and excluded, and later on what kind of consequences that can have in doing anything in certain areas?
Sure.
So I'm just, you know, if it's loosely agreed upon or it's locally preferred alternative of doing it that way, or there was a tight methodology behind it, because if it is something in a spirit of protection of the area, then but doesn't have specific criteria, it could be a subject to dispute later on down the line of why this and not the other, and what kind of explanation will we have in approving or not approving or designating or not designating that. That's the clarification I need to understand what we're doing, why, and how it's going to hold up.
Yeah, and to answer it, it might help first to say that the boundaries for a National Heritage Area are of much less consequence than the boundaries for a national park or a national monument or something that has some level of, you know, greater role for the federal government, in this case the National Park Service. The National Heritage Area Program was really designed to help show showcase regions of the country that have significant culture and history and where the influence of people has led to an important effect on the landscape. It has no federal land use authority. There's no federal land use ownership. There's no intention for this ever to become a different type of federal land unit where you might have that type of larger federal role. However, you do have to establish a boundary within which you're, you know, you have something on the map that shows where this area is located. One thing we're talking to people about who are concerned, even after they understand that there's no federal ownership, no federal oversight, no federal overlay, one thing that gives people some comfort is that no one is required to be a part of this National Heritage Area. People have to opt in and elect to become what's called a partner site. And the partner sites are just those, they might be facilities, or they might be historic buildings, or they might even be businesses that have elected to align themselves with the National Heritage Area. And then those are the entities that are listed in the collateral material. And, you know, here are the people who are participating in the Delta National Heritage Area.
Yeah. Just my concern remains to, like, if it is something for protection of an area and showcasing of it, then, and it has some implications at some point, how do we decide somebody is in it and not? And how do we decide something's more protected versus something else in areas that are so, you know, close and, as you said, Stockton and the other areas? That's my question that remains, not that I disagree, but right. It remains a question for me of what kind of implication this might have in the future. There's either a value to it, which is the value of showcasing and protection, and therefore we did this, or if it's nothing, then... You know,
well, it's this is the way I explain it. It's really having the National Park Service seal, kind of the good housekeeping seal of approval, I think of it as, on this region, saying the National Park Service thinks that the Sacramento Delta region has important features that warrant in all the areas, you know, regions throughout the country. There are about 40 of these designated areas throughout the country currently. There are none in California. So this would be the first National Heritage Area in California. Mm-hmm. But it provides a platform to be able to promote the region as a tourism destination, as a place. And I was just in Joshua Tree National Park over the weekend. I hadn't been down there for a long time. There are a lot more people going to Joshua Tree than there used to be. And I think, you know, you have that National Park Service seal on something. It's going to draw people's attention. It certainly will help us provide a better platform for promoting the region, because we can say, come to the, you know, nationally heralded Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. Come check out our cultural and heritage sites within the region.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Well. Good morning again, Chair and Council members. Thank you for the opportunity. It is red dot. Hello?
Yeah, just closer.
Closer. Hello. Okay. So thank you for the opportunity to be here to give a quarterly update. My first slide is really just a reminder of who we are. We are a state conservancy. We were created as part of the Delta Reform Act at the same time the Stewardship Council was created. We do have a governing board of 11 voting members, which includes public members, agency leads, and then 5 county supervisors, one from each of the 5 counties in the Delta. Our main purpose on the slide there is really to be an agency that does ecosystem restoration in the Delta and economic development as well. Great. So I'm just going to provide 3 real highlights of some of the things that we're up to. I'm going to talk a little bit about our collaborative planning, our regional planning efforts. I'll talk a little bit about our proposition funding and our projects that we're putting on the landscape currently. And then I'll talk a little bit about subsidence reversal and carbon emissions in the Delta. Small subset of some of our highest priorities, but we're very actively engaged with the Stewardship Council and the Delta Protection Commission on a number of issues, including the Chapter 4 revision. We're members of the Adaptive Management Interagency Integration Team, as well as that steering committee. We do a lot of work on trying to develop tools to help track restoration projects and performance measures related to restoration projects. And, of course, we're DPIC members as well. So, first off, our regional planning. The intent here is to, consistent with the Delta Plan, is to try to look at regions within the Delta and bring together local interest agencies, experts, and landowners to really think very critically about a particular region. What is it that we think we can do ecologically? How does that fit on the landscape? How does that affect the local agriculture, flood protection, water supply? And can we work together to identify a path forward that hopefully has local support? We've done this in two significant watersheds in the Delta, the Cache Slough Complex. We did what we called a phase one, which is essentially working with all those interests to look at the data sets and think about how things line up and where opportunities present. Unfortunately, that group, I think largely out of capacity constraints, did not decide to go that next step and do a full-blown strategy for that area. And the other area that we worked on is what we just recently released and we're calling our Delta Public Land Strategy. So that is where we brought together all of the owners of public lands throughout the Delta, really trying to be responsive to the Delta community's request that if we're going to do restoration, we do it on publicly owned lands first. Brought those landowners together with surrounding landowners, reclamation district engineers, agency experts, basically anybody who had an interest, and worked over about a nine-month period to try to define a strategy. How do we think about these lands? How do we achieve as much ecological benefit as we can? How do we do that in a way that's respectful and mindful of the overall economic viability of the regions and the agriculture? And so that strategy is available on our website. It's actually I like to call it a mercifully brief document. It's about 25 pages long. And it just helps those agencies think collectively about these islands as well as individually about the things they might do moving forward. So shifting a little bit to our Proposition 1 funding, and I've got our Prop 68 logo up there as well. We are currently in our fourth cycle of funding Proposition 1 projects. Those are ecosystem restoration projects, water quality projects, and ag sustainability projects that relate to ecosystem. We've done three cycles previously. We currently have 19 awarded projects with about $24 million actively moving on the ground. Currently, we're reviewing proposals in our Cycle 4, and the current request for Cycle 4 is about $16 million. So if we actually award all that's requested in this cycle, we will be about through our $50 million allotment of Proposition 1 funds. And the right-hand column there, you see essentially acres impacted. Now, this is we do planning projects as well as implementation projects, so these are combinations of those planning dollars and planning projects and implementation projects. But you can see the types of habitats that types of projects that we are actually putting on the ground with that $50 million in Prop 1. We're pretty proud of that. A lot of these projects actually contribute to the non-biological opinion components of EcoRestore, but clearly we're out there putting some ecological benefit on the landscape. Proposition 68, we have $12 million available, and we're going to use that funding for Delta as place, or essentially the second half of our mandate, which is economic development. So we're very excited that after 9 years of existence, we have a pot of money to actually do some economic development type work, promoting the Delta, looking for recreation and access opportunities. And we just this week made an offer, and it was accepted to our Proposition 68 lead. So in the very near future, that person will be developing our grant guidelines and our solicitation process, and we'll start to move that money to projects in the system. So the last thing I wanted to highlight is subsidence and related carbon emissions in the Delta. We've spent a tremendous amount of effort over the years And I think this is an area that we need to refocus on a little bit collectively. For all of our effort in planning in the Delta, current activities continue to subside land elevations in the Delta up to 1 to 2 inches a year. We all know that the threat of that is what's driving a lot of the planning in the Delta. There's a chance that we could lose the Western Delta to an inland sea and have a 3 to 36 month interruption in exports from the state and federal water system. In addition, that 25 feet of land loss that we have lost essentially is carbon that is cooked off into the atmosphere and continues to do so at a rate of about 2 million metric tons of carbon coming off the Delta per year. And that's a result of draining the land for agriculture and microbial oxidation. That's the equivalent of about 500,000 vehicles. It's just an enormous source of carbon. So given those two efforts, or those two realities, the risk as well as the level of carbon emission, we're trying to gain focus, get funding to actually do land conversion, and try to look at this area and think about how we realize landscape scale change. This slide just mentions a few of the activities. We have an approved methodology through the American Carbon Registry that looks at managed wetland and or rice cultivation and allows people to convert their land, engage the carbon market, and get a revenue stream from that. We're working with public and private landowners to develop pilot projects that show how this works. We're working with carbon financiers that are interested in marketing the carbon that can come off the Delta. And interestingly, it's sort of viewed as a charismatic carbon credit. People that buy voluntary market credits are very interested. We believe we can market and sell all the credits that we can actually verify within the Delta. But most importantly, we're seeking that funding to be able to go out and work with pilot projects, help them do the land conversion, give them technical assistance to work through the protocol processes, and then realize these changes and revenue streams. We're in ongoing discussions with the Air Resources Board because we'd very much like to see this protocol adopted into the compliance market, which significantly increases the value of that carbon. This table right here, just very quickly, will show sort of what the numbers, how they pan out in the Delta right now. On every acre in the Delta, we're putting out about 15 metric tons of carbon per year. That soil loss of 1 inch equates to about 15 metric tons of carbon that volatilizes per acre. In a carbon market, this is the voluntary carbon market on the left, you're going to provide a bit of a buffer pool, which is if you have a contract that helps guarantee if you have intentional or unintentional reversals that's accounted for. You're going to take 11 credits per acre to the market, currently at about $7 a ton or a credit, and that's going to give you about $77 gross revenue per acre. You've got some verification and validation cost, and that gets you to about $57 an acre. That's not much of an incentive in the Delta right now. It's a small amount of funding. You look at the next column over, though, that's the jump to the compliance market. So, again, working with ARB to try to get to that level, they're interested. But that takes you up to $18 per credit and about $170 net per acre. Now, that's starting to compete with corn in the Delta. So in these deeply subsided Western Islands, you start to see a market mechanism that is commensurate or a bit higher than corn and therefore much more appealing. The high case for the compliance market is a $30 price point per metric or per credit. There's lots of people speculating that's very realistic and very likely, and that gets us to $302 per credit per acre. Very competitive. If you look at rice cultivation, your carbon market values go down a little bit because at some point in the season, you have dry land, so you continue to do the oxidation. But then you also get the revenue from rice, which is actually quite high. So we really view this as a story that's very compelling. You look at the risk associated with the restoration, the magnitude of the carbon emissions and our statewide climate objectives, and then the fact that we actually have market mechanisms that can help us really incentivize at appropriate levels to make change. We're pretty excited and also just very working very hard again to get focus program resources to try to make to try to address these issues at scale in the Delta. So I'll leave that as my update and appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thanks.
Any questions for Campbell, council members? Ken?
I'm going to take a chance and try and connect some dots here.
Great.
So the economic sustainability plan for the Protection Council, you know, focuses on tourism, agricultural sustainability, those types of things. And then Campbell, you know, what you're focused on is restoration, with that can have some positive economic impact on the Delta, or kind of help support the Protection Commission's economic sustainability plan. And then the Delta plan, you know, Delta as place, you know, all of this sort of, we're trying to achieve the same thing, but we're also, you know, in Chapter 4, where we're trying to do ecosystem restoration. So, you know, I just kind of quickly added up the acres impacted on, and I think it was like about 15,000 acres, you know, on impacted the slide. You have a title, subtitle, wetlands, non-title.
Yeah, the funding that we're putting on the ground in Proposition 1.
Yeah, so just as an example, so that 15,000 acres, if you restore all that, you're getting carbon credits, or you're developing a bank, you know.
Yeah, those are a little bit separable, because not all of those. So to get carbon credits, you have to inundate the land, re-wet the land. A lot of these projects here don't actually involve that type of wetting, but
a subset of those. Yes. So we've had a lot of discussion. Here's the connecting the dots. We've had a lot of discussion here about sort of Fish and Wildlife's plan for restoration, and, you know, publicly available land first, and protecting agriculture. And so is there consistency? I mean, as we develop our ecosystem restoration amendment and say, gee, we need this to have a functional ecosystem, is there consistency and connection between all of these efforts? And you know, you mentioned... Well, let you answer the question. So first, it's sort of like it seemed very important that it was public lands and willing sellers and that kind of thing, and maintaining the agricultural identity of the Delta in restoration.
So my sense is that we're absolutely working together to try to tie these together. Certainly, we can always do better. We're actively engaged in the Chapter 4 revision to try to make sure that some of these concepts are showing up there. And I think they will. Eric and I met just yesterday talking about the land use and management plan and the draft, and how we might incorporate a little bit more about subsidence and carbon emissions into that document as it moves forward. So I think they're interwoven pretty well, and we're certainly all aware of all the different efforts and trying to maintain that coordination.
Okay, so is Eric your land use plan? I mean, sort of the, you know, foundations of all of these things, are they all working together? And then I think for our staff, you know, how are we looking at this in terms of Chapter 4 and what we're going to do in the future?
Well, the land use plan is really local government oversight. Oversight over local government land use decisions within the primary zone, and really intended to ensure that, again, going back to the original purpose of the Delta Protection Act, or at least the concern that led to the legislation, was the incursion of urbanization into the Delta. So the land use plan's really intended to ensure that local government land use decisions are not leading to additional urbanization in the primary zone. There's a lot of reasons why there's not a lot of push for additional urbanization in the primary zone, and it probably has a lot more to do with flood regulations and the flood-prone nature of that region than it does the existence of our plan. But our plan's not intended to solve all that ails out there. We rely on the Delta plan for that. We're just really restricting and regulating local government land use decisions within the primary zone.
Okay, now that's an important point because, you know, we can look at the Delta plan as sort of the umbrella document, and, you know, how do all these plans, and maybe there's an easy answer from Jessica to this, but how do all these plans sort of come together? Because, you know, our charge beyond the achievement of the co-equal goals is consistency in planning and understanding how we connect those dots. And maybe that's, you know, sort of covered, because a lot of times I bring stuff up and it's like, well, we dealt with it. But I don't know. You know, and that's why it seems like how you connect the dots is important here. And the fact that, you know, I think with Campbell, your report and what I know of the ecosystem restoration amendment, we're really focused on sea level rise and impacts from climate change, which is going to affect land area in the Delta. So how do we bring all this stuff together? And I know it's not easy, but I think it's an important question for this council, since we're responsible for the Delta plan. So I don't know. I asked a lot of questions. Yeah. Maybe you can connect. You guys.
I'm not sure what more to add other than, I mean, it's part of how we're developing the draft chapter 4 to bring to you now is through conversations with our interagency partners, conversations with stakeholders. So ensuring that, you know, there's not accidental conflict, and if we do identify conflicts, that we bring those to the council for discussion and deliberation and ultimately decisions about what to what direction to take in the Delta Plan chapter amendments. So I mean, the council's number one way of operating is collaboration, and so almost every day our staffs are meeting. We're making presentations at each other's boards. We're reviewing each other's documents. So it's happening. But to the extent that conflicts do arise, then that'll be subject to conversation here at the council.
Well, it's also, you know, it's a two-way conversation, and it's a two-way street in that, you know, we should be doing things to support what those agencies, those organizations are
Absolutely.
Trying to do and,
yes.
and, you know, not just, hey, here's what we want you to do. So it's that it'd be helpful maybe as we identify the issues and the points of convergence to know what they are, so that we know we're all on the same page.
Agreed.
Thank you both for your presentations and answering all those tough questions. Are there any comments from the public on this agenda item? No? Okay. Well, then let's move on to agenda item 8. I am really excited about this dashboard. I got a pre-screening. Well, it wasn't just for me. I sat at the back of the room observing a test audience. So looking forward to this presentation.
Great. Well, I kind of like to introduce this item by saying that publishing the website, the database for performance measures, the dashboard, which allows detailed tracking of 32 output and outcome performance measures, is really a milestone to be celebrated. It's the first ever comprehensive set of performance measures for the Delta, first ever. Many before us tried and failed to do this, although it's long been recognized that it's necessary to track status and trends for some of the Delta's key assets and functions. It certainly was not easy. In fact, we were sued over our first attempt to do so, and it took us years of effort to get to the point where we felt we had relevant, supportable, peer-reviewed measures that can actually be tracked. The actually being tracked part is very important. In other words, where there's sufficient, funded, and regularly collected data that we can rely upon. So the 2005 Little Hoover Commission report, which some of you may recall, looked at the successes and the failures of CalFed, which was the predecessor agency to the council. And one of their key conclusions was that it was lack of performance measures that was a key failing of that effort.
So even though the agencies and the stakeholders attempted to develop performance measures, my understanding from talking to people who worked on that effort, and in fact, Chair Tatayan, I believe, was part of that effort at some point, is it was just too controversial, and data sets were very limited at that time. And so no set of performance measures were ever adopted despite efforts to do so. So the finding by the Little Hoover Commission no doubt led to the inclusion of a statutory mandate in the Delta Reform Act for the council to adopt quantitative performance measures. So together, these performance measures are a new tool for the council. They're a tool for the public and for our sister agencies to track not just the health of the system, but also to give us feedback on whether the Delta plan is working. It will require patience. Essentially, we've established the baseline. We've just begun the data collection. We're moving into that phase now, but we're excited today to show you the fruits of our hard work and to highlight two of the 32 performance measures so you can get an idea of what's happening. Okay, and with that, I'll introduce Martina Kohler.
Thank you, Jessica. Good afternoon, council members. Today, I would like to present a tool for viewing and tracking the Delta Plan performance measures adopted by the Council in 2018. The Delta Reform Act of 2009 gave guidance on the performance measures. The Delta Reform Act required the Delta Plan to include a set of performance measures that are based on, that include quantified or otherwise measurable targets and methods of performance assessment to measure the progress in meeting objectives of the Delta Plan. The effort to set the numeric metrics, baseline, and targets was a multi-year effort, as Jessica mentioned, and culminated last year in 2018 when the Council adopted the 32 performance measures. These measures track progress in achieving the Delta Plan outputs and outcomes. So right after the adoption and as a last year priority, the dashboard project was initiated. The objectives of the dashboard is to enable visual tracking of the Delta Plan performance measures and to provide access to and communicate the performance metrics, baselines, and targets. The project began with assessing users' needs from council staff and a couple of council members and other Delta Plan implementing agencies. Today, the project is reaching a milestone of publishing and going live. This morning, we released the website with the performance measures dashboard as a test or as a soft release. We will continue talking to users and stakeholders and finalize improving the content and features of the dashboard. This presentation will feature two measures to demonstrate the tool. Performance measures are organized by Delta Plan chapters. So next, I show a sample measure in the water supply category. In the water supply section, there are six performance measures, and this chapter page provides access to all water supply performance measures, and under each measure is a short abstract about the measure. So next, I will go into the water supply reliability measure. The water supply reliability is an outcome measure and addresses the Delta Plan core strategy of increasing water conservation and expanding local and regional supplies. For this measure, the definition of reliability is to plan for sufficient water supply during a single dry year and during 3 years of drought. Urban water suppliers demonstrate their projected reliability in the urban water management plans. The expectation is that urban suppliers ensure their water sources meet demand during dry years without increasing reliance on the Delta water. The metric is percentage of water suppliers projecting reliability during single and multi-year droughts. The data portion of the dashboard displays graphs with the percentage of water suppliers projecting shortages no greater than 20% during single year, that's the blue bar, and multi-year drought, that's the red bar. The target is 100% of suppliers will provide water with no more than 20% shortage by 2020. An interactive map shows on the dashboard shows allows users to select a specific hydrologic region and to obtain the results relevant to that region. So the data come from 2015 Urban Water Management Plans. And the graphs here show Sacramento River, San Joaquin River, and South Coast regions the approach 100%, and San Francisco region meets only 60 to 80% of the target. So these values will be updated again using the 2020 Urban Water Management Plan to demonstrate, or plans to demonstrate, whether the target is achieved in each hydrologic region or state overall. So to feature another measure, I will go to the Delta Ecosystem chapter. Here there are four performance measures for restoring a healthier estuary under the core strategy of creating a more natural functional flows. And note that additional performance measures will be added to this set after the ecosystem amendment project further revises and refines additional performance measures for the ecosystem. So one of the measures is the Yellow Bypass floodplain inundation that I will feature next. So this one is an outcome measure. The expectation is the frequent Yellow Bypass inundation will contribute to supporting native fish when they enter the flooded Yellow Bypass area. The metric includes the area of inundation with the target of 17,000 acres. The metric also measures the duration of flooding because longer flooding supports more productive food webs. Longer duration of flooding contributes to better native fish growth, better survival of juvenile fish, and improve ecological functions of the system. The data portion of the measure in this slide shows a time series for the number of consecutive days the Fremont Weir overtops from 1997 to 2018. The Fremont Weir is at the top of the Yellow Bypass, and at the 6,000 CFS flow, it overtops and allows flooding of the Yellow Bypass. This target also requires sufficient inundation for 14 days every 2 out of 3 years and 21 days every 1 out of 2 years. So the target is to be achieved by 2020. Coming back to the landing page of the dashboard, there are 32 performance measures. And these two measures were examples to illustrate some of the dashboard features. I would encourage you to go to the website and explore the information at your convenience. And the website is also available on mobile devices and on your smartphone. Tracking performance of the Delta requires patience. We have just only started reporting on the performance measures, performance assessment and interpretations of trends and outcomes for the measure will require time and additional data. In conclusion, the dashboard enables visual tracking of the performance measures adopted by the Council in 2018. As we gather performance data from now to the target dates, the tool will provide a view of the status and trends. It will communicate to a diverse audience and provide multiple levels of details, from high-level key insights to detailed data analysis, methods, and results. A printed hard copy guidebook was provided in your folders is a companion to this web-based tool. The printed handbook provides an overview of the performance measures, and it's another resource to assist in building a common understanding of the performance metrics and expectations. As we gather data and reach milestones, performance measures can be reported in the Council annual reports. If Council members are interested, we can also come back to future meetings and present information on specific measures as data become available. This concludes my presentation. I would like to thank staff who contributed to this effort and who are also here today and available to assist with questions.
Thank you, Martina. Council members, any questions about the performance measures and the dashboard? Oscar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Martina, for the presentation. So a couple comments. First of all, the website, nicely done. It's easy to track. It's appealing. It's fun to play with, I guess, for lack of a better term, because I did that yesterday, and it was fun to play with. I actually think, though, that in light of in the society that we're in currently, with sort of we're inundated with a lot of information, it seems like, mm-hmm. and so you're constantly constantly struggling to try to find a way to make the information that we're creating rise above everything else so that people actually pay attention to it and watch it. And so I think I would suggest, and I don't want to throw a wrench into anything, but we might actually incorporate even just short videos or clips of things that are happening so that folks have a visual of what's occurring. So in addition to the website, for mm-hmm. example, right now, for those who are interested, and I certainly am, with the functional flows in the bypass, in the yellow bypass, the weir is currently open, and there is a lot of water flowing through there. And all of the benefits are impossible to get your head around if you're the average person driving by seeing a lot of water going through the bypass. It's an enormous amount of water. But the benefits are enormous as well. And so I think even just something as simple as a quick video to show folks exactly what is happening and how our systems are benefiting from it would be good as well. I offer that as a suggestion going forward in the event that that's an opportunity. So
great idea.
Yeah. Cool.
Thanks. Any other questions? So I have to say that this is remarkable in my mind because, as Jessica said, this is the first time that we have performance measures in a format that does not force anyone to read through a 3-inch binder to figure out what performance measure relates to what requirement in the Delta Plan. And having some experience in developing a website with very complex data, to me, this is from what I've seen, this is a great job, and it is not only a performance measure dashboard, it is a collection of data and is an interactive database. So I encourage you to explore the site. For example, on Delta Ecosystem, the functional flows, clicking on that will give you information presented in a manner that a college freshman can understand, that a PhD can explore further, a level of detail you can stay as high level as you want, or you can dig down into the weeds. This is a phenomenal accomplishment. It brings together data from many departments and many sources, and our sister agencies are already looking to our performance measures. For example, the State Water Resources Control Board, as it proceeds on the Bay Delta Water Quality Plan update, is keeping in mind these measures of functional flow, which, of course, will affect water supply reliability and an enhanced ecosystem. So congratulations to the team that has this live today. Thank you very much, and I look forward to hearing from the public and the users how the data is used, any improvements, and I like Oscar's suggestion, you know, we need to get above the many websites out there, and I look forward to the next version. I don't know, Jeff Martina, is there... This is called a soft launch. What happens after the soft launch?
Well, we will, if there are some fixes, and we will be talking to agencies or like those who provide data to kind of make sure everything works well, you know, what are the improvements that we can do, and then just have a hard launch. But then, as I said, after the ecosystem performance, additional ecosystem performance measures are finalized, those will be added as well in a year.
One of the other things I might add is this also allows us now a tracking mechanism going forward. So we're essentially at this stage where we have baseline data, we have targets, we have a couple data points here and there. as time goes by and as additional data is available, we'll have additional data points, we'll start to see trends, which then can influence future policy decisions. So I think at the council's pleasure, we would potentially bring back individual trends that we see that may have policy implications for discussion.
Madam Chair?
Oscar.
Yeah, just one other thought that I had, again, going back to kind of information overload, and once people go to a website, they'll take a look at it, they'll see whether or not it adds value and its functionalities, and if the data seemingly or the data points seemingly are somewhat static, in other words, they've gone back two or three times months later and they see the numbers really haven't changed, but there's no indication of when the numbers are likely to change, the propensity for folks to kind of move on and look for a more dynamic set of data points is very good. So to the extent that we might be able to identify going forward what the next iteration or what the next refresh of those data points will be, it gives the viewer, the user,
context
for how and when to come back, because managing expectations on the front end is always tricky, right? So it looks great, a lot of good stuff, but nothing changes 6, 8, 10, 12 months later. And in some cases, that is going to be the case. In fact, it may be many years before certain data points move. So I just so that it doesn't lose its dynamicness about it, we think about maybe identifying points at which the information will be updated within reason so that the user has some semblance of when to expect the refresh. So yeah. One more thought.
Yeah. Good feedback.
Great ideas. Thank you.
Thank you both. Do we have any public comments on this item, Lita? No public comments. Okay, on to agenda item 9, Delta Climate Change Vulnerability Assessment and Adaptation Strategy.
Okay, great. And as Kate Anderson, our senior environmental planner, comes to the table alongside Jeff Henderson, they are going to provide an update on the council's development of a Delta Climate Change Vulnerability Assessment and subsequent adaptation strategy. And today would like to seek your initial guidance on draft resilience goals to guide the overall effort.
Okay. Thank you, Jessica. With regard to this item, before we provide a bit of an overview of the project, we wanted to give council members also an overview of the types of climate change impacts that we know are expected for the Delta going forward. We know that we're potentially looking at higher sea levels, levee subsidence, greater flood, both frequency and magnitude, that would threaten Delta levees and the assets and the resources that are protected by those levees, including residents, critical state infrastructure like water exports, energy transmission lines, roads, and tidal habitats. We know we're anticipating higher water and air temperatures that would threaten Delta native species, potential for saltwater intrusion, which could threaten areas where water is pumped for agricultural and municipal uses, the potential for more frequent and extreme heat stress risk, especially for outdoor occupations and for recreation, the potential for increased air pollution exposure from wildfires, and the potential for reduced snowpack, along with more variable and extreme precipitation that could reduce water supplies for people and ecosystems. These are outcomes of the fourth climate assessment, which was prepared by the state under the leadership of the Governor's Office of Planning and Research. On the screen, you'll see that one of the things that that assessment did was break down the potential risks or stressors by region, and we're looking particularly at the regions for the Sacramento Valley and the San Joaquin Valley as they most directly affect the Delta. And the types of impacts that I just mentioned are those that we most anticipate being of considerable impact to the Delta. With regard to a problem statement for this project, the Delta Independent Science Board provides oversight of the scientific research monitoring and assessment programs that affect how we manage and approach the Delta. And the ISB has offered recently a draft letter to the Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee indicating the vulnerability, the potential vulnerability of the Delta to these climate change effects. Just the second part of that statement, climate change is affecting all Delta problems and will bring new problems. These urgent problems provide an opportunity to refashion how the state develops, manages, and employs scientific and technical information as we look at policy and management in the Delta. This is really what I think we view as the key charge for this study, is to how do we adapt the way that we approach policy and the way that the state manages its investments and systems in the Delta in the face of climate change. So by way of today's discussion, I would like to provide just a brief overview of the project and then set expectations regarding what staff ultimately would like to discuss with the council and allow the council to set expectations for the project itself as well. So we'll provide a brief background on the project, discuss the goals, process, and timeline, and at the conclusion of the presentation, we'd really like to engage in a discussion with the council members to solicit feedback on an initial set of resilience goals that are tracking with the project, get an understanding of whether the project adequately, in your assessment, reflects state interests in the Delta, and to gauge what the council's level of interest in engaging in the project is going forward. Sort of the frequency of check-ins, the type of information that you'd like us to bring to you, and the level of guidance that the council members would like to provide for the study. So with that, I'll turn it over to Kate to help summarize the project background.
Thank you, Jeff. So we thought it would be helpful to provide a bit of background in terms of what the statutory obligations are within the Reform Act and how climate change is featured within the Delta Plan. Climate change really features in two places within the Reform Act. It obligates restoration planning to consider climate change out to 2100, and then it also obligates us to consider the effects of climate change on state highways that cross through the Delta. Within the Delta Plan, climate change is discussed really throughout the narrative and is featured in two of our regulatory policies. The first being an obligation to consider elevations in restoration planning. And so the map on your right, you can kind of see that there are areas that would accommodate sea level rise. And that's one place where climate change is within one of our regulatory policies. The second is one called RRP2, which for some residential development that is in the Delta, it obligates that sea level rise be featured and part of design requirements for some portions of residential development in the Delta. With respect to the recommendations within the Delta Plan, which really are geared towards coordination and collaboration with other agencies that would help us achieve the co-equal goals. Climate change is featured within five recommendations and includes things like the next Sassoon Marsh plan update. It should consider sea level rise in that planning update. One other place to call attention to the Science Action Agenda, which is the shared Science Action Agenda for 2017 to 2021. Climate change is featured within two of those priority science actions, one being, for example, that species refugia during extreme climate events should be identified. So that really provides a background of how and where climate change is within our current statutory obligations and within the Delta Plan. And since 2013, there's been a host of advances both in the science and policy world and really provided a background for why we embarked on this. In the science and policy and regulatory arena, I think probably Jeff described some of the fourth climate change assessment results that we're certainly paying attention to. Guidance from the Ocean Protection Council on how sea level rise should be interpreted for state agencies. That's another kind of key landmark. There have also been Delta Plan amendments that you have been a part of. There on the right is a synthesis. Technical and journal reports to really try to understand what this means for the ecosystem. We'll go into a little bit further detail in the rest of the presentation, describing both the legislative and the state obligations for climate change planning at both the state and local level. Some of those. Some of those requirements are kind of identified there by name, and we'll touch on those in a greater detail in a moment, as well as the local government plans that are in place.
Just so folks who are watching on the web are aware, we're in a setting where it sounds like they might be watching some kind of sporting event next door. So the reason that people are grinning is we're just trying to hear each other while we hear the entertainment next door.
Checking on whether we can do anything about that.
Thanks, Susan. So with that kind of background in place, we felt the urgency and the need to embark on this project, and this really, what we're basing our project really on four basic approaches going forward. We're going to reflect the Reform Act obligations as well as the assets and resources described within the Delta Plan. So that means water supplies, the ecosystem, the Delta's place from things that you heard Eric touch on earlier, including residents, agriculture, roads, energy infrastructure, disadvantaged communities, as well as flood management, so things like levees and floodplains and emergency preparedness. We will also be applying state guidance. There is a rich array of guidance that state agencies have put forward for both state and local governments in planning and incorporating what climate change might mean for their different authorities. And so things like the Governor's Office of Planning and Research, their guidance for state agencies will be, you know, directly pulling from things like that. We will also be applying lessons learned from the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, BCDC's Adapting to Rising Tides program, which in the Bay really offers a great model for how local engagement can be successfully embarked on in collaboration with local government. So we'll be taking lessons learned from that approach in the Bay, as well as using best available science. I think Jeff will go into this in greater detail in a moment, but several members on our technical advisory committee for this project actually made contributions to the fourth assessment, and so we'll be and already are directly pulling in best available science for this project going forward. I'll turn that over to you.
Okay. Thank you, Kate. So I'm going to provide just a brief overview of the project itself, the phases of the project, and the different activities that we'll be engaging in. Essentially, we've broken this project into two key phases. First, a vulnerability assessment, taking stock of the assets present in the Delta and the potential exposure of those assets to sea level rise and other climate change impacts. And then secondly, preparation of an adaptation strategy, where once we understand the range of assets and the level of exposure, what are the options for helping these resources and assets adapt to climate change conditions? Along the way, we're going to be engaging different parties, including the council, a technical advisory committee that's been assembled to help support the project in terms of providing technical background, ensuring the use of best available science, ensuring the use of best management practices from an engineering perspective as we're looking at different modeling that will help to support the project, And then ultimately, as we go further into the adaptation strategy, beginning to engage a stakeholder work group, which is comprised of local agency representatives. So our intent there is to gain participation from counties and cities that would be affected in the Delta area, as well as resident groups and other stakeholders, particularly including representation from disadvantaged communities in the Delta. And then ultimately, moving forward with that adaptation strategy, we will begin to look at what are options for each asset or asset class to potentially protect those resources, to accommodate a certain level of sea level rise, which is easier to do with certain types of assets than others, or in the need to consider retreat strategies if there are simply assets that cannot thrive within a changed environment, then those are cases where we'd need to look at different retreat strategies. So that's ultimately in the adaptation strategy phase, where we would wind up with recommendations that we would certainly discuss with the council in an effort to help prioritize recommendations such that local agencies could act upon them, other state agencies could act upon them, and indeed some may even come into the form of a future Delta Plan amendment. So that's kind of the range of activities that we envision coming from the adaptation strategy. Looking forward to discussions at that phase of the project with the council to help us to prioritize those outcomes. So Kate's going to talk a little bit about our resilience goals, which will be the topic for our discussion this afternoon.
And I think it's a really great segue, but especially as it relates to the adaptation strategy, how will we be evaluating and considering the different strategies that we will be prioritizing and hopefully moving forward on? And that's where these Delta climate change resilience goals come into place. So attachment 2 in your binder today provides the staff initial draft of what those long-term Delta vision, Delta values and priorities could be in terms of how can we persist and continue valuing those in the face of a changing climate. These draw upon the co-equal goals for the Delta and apply as well the sustainability framework that the ART program in the Bay put forward in trying to think holistically about all of the types of values and considerations that we're trying to bear in mind here. And so that means for us, those themes are water, environment, society and equity, the economy and governance. The purpose, again, for these resilience goals is to be able to evaluate the adaptation options going forward, identify trade-offs between them, and from that, prioritize ones that are holistic in nature and help us achieve those goals across those five themes. In terms of process, we will be refining these goals after we receive input from you today. And then as we engage stakeholders, we will also be incorporating refinements from them. And we recommend that we revisit these goals after the vulnerability assessment is completed to make sure that they still reflect the priorities and needs for the project going forward. And so what we wanted to give you a sense of the project timeline and where these major milestones will take place over the next couple years. So right now the project team is really early on in scoping out the vulnerability assessment. We expect to have draft conclusions ready by fall of this year and a final report hopefully by late winter, early spring, at which point we'll transition into the adaptation strategy in spring of next year, move forward through that process, and come back with a final adaptation strategy in probably fall of 2021. We also wanted to provide you a little bit of a closer snapshot of local government activities that are relevant for this project that are occurring in the region. As Jeff mentioned, local government engagement is really critical for the success of this project. And we were, I think, pleasantly surprised and pleased as we were looking at local plans, the degree to which regional collaboration is really emphasized across the five county plans that touch on climate change, and how each of them have policies and recommendations in place to collaborate regionally. And so going forward, staff will be reaching out to local governments to make sure that we're all in sync and using and operating off of the same baseline of information. We also wanted to give you a quick snapshot of who we've talked with and raised awareness of this project with over the past couple months. And so we've reached out to our sister agencies. Some of them are there before you, as well as local governments. And we have presented at a couple different work groups and collaborations. So that's just a sense of who we're starting to reach out to. And then I think it's attachment one in terms of some of the expertise and academic institutions that we're also hoping to leverage here going forward. Those are the members of our technical advisory committee, which we're really excited to have really leading experts across multiple disciplines to help us in the project going forward.
Okay, so we would like to use the rest of our time for this agenda item to seek feedback on the goals that Kate discussed, which are provided in attachment two. Talk a little about the project scope in terms of the state interests and understand again the degree of the council's interest in the project and key feedback points going forward. So for discussion purposes, the slide indicates a few questions with regard to the goals. And essentially, do you view those goals as complete or holistic, I think, as Kate mentioned? Are there items that are missing? Are there key things that we should be considering with regard to climate change effects in the Delta that aren't spoken to by the resilience goals? Thinking about the project scope as well as those resilience goals, we're curious council's interest in terms of where staff should focus our efforts. When we consider the range of activities that run from economic risks to infrastructure risks, risks to people and property, risks to state water supply reliability and the ecosystem. Again, these are, I think as Councilmember Weinberg indicated earlier, these are all the things that are kind of at interplay as we look at climate change risks. How do we look at prioritizing among them when necessary? And then ultimately, what is the council's level of interest in the project going forward, ranging from us providing direction, ranging from council members providing direction on potential adaptation alternatives, again, in that second phase of the study where we're looking at trade-offs and prioritization. I think from a staff perspective, that's clearly where we would be very much anticipating council input to help with the prioritization of adaptation strategies. But are there other places, when you consider the scope of the project, where the council would like to provide that level of guidance to staff? And then there's also the potential to hear from practitioners, others who've conducted climate change assessments and adaptation strategies, either at the local level or perhaps at the regional level as well, for lessons learned and awareness of these issues. So these are the range of activities that we certainly could engage with the council regarding the study. Would be very interested and curious as to your perspectives and input, both as relates to the specific goals, the resilience goals that have been provided in attachment two, as well as the breadth and scope of the study itself. So with that, would very much entertain questions or discussion.
Council members,
I
Sorry about that. We've gotten them to lower their microphone and move their speaker, but I'm not sure what more we'll be able to do for the rest of the meeting.
I just wouldn't pay rent. That's what I suggest. I'm trying to understand. Obviously, this is way over my head in many ways, so I apologize for the question. But when you deal with the vulnerability assessment, for example, that affects state water supply. It would seem to me that's very, very much connected. How would you go about tying the vulnerability assessment with the state water supply? How would you measure that?
Sure, and I think that's one of the first questions everybody has. That is something that we're currently scoping out with our project team and with our technical advisory committee on how can we, what are the methods and the approach that we can use to evaluate the risks to the water supplies. So it's a step in the process that we're right in the middle of.
I'd also add that the Department of Water Resources recently completed an evaluation specific to their assets, including the State Water Project, and what effects of climate change they expect to see there. So we're starting to go through those documents. We've got those members on our team, and then we hope to bring you more information as we better understand it.
It seems like there would be a linkage to the levy investment strategy decision support tool. I don't see a reference to that specifically. Describe how the outputs from this will help to inform or update the decision support tool.
Sure, I'm glad you asked that question. So the vulnerability assessment considers assets and resources that are described within the Delta Plan, many of which, as you know, D-List also considered. So we will be leveraging and building upon that database. And I think what's really exciting is we will be pulling directly from the ECO Amendment work to sort of in real time integrate better and best available information on what the ecosystem needs might mean for this climate vulnerability assessment. So we'll be, one, leveraging the work that D-List did. And I think, two, in terms of the pivot to the adaptation strategy, it's going to be, I think, maybe a little bit broader in scope than just identifying a set of high-priority islands and tracts, for example, that are at risk from climate-specific factors and hazards. And so it's a little bit broader than just levees and islands. We're also going to be thinking about climate change impacts and stressors like extreme heat and air temperatures and air pollution and wildfire, that type of stuff. So it's a little bit broader than D-List, I think. The timeline is also a little bit further out. I think D-List it looked out to 2050, and our time horizon is 2100. With that said, we'll be looking at those thresholds and tipping points, along the way that are meaningful for some of the goals that are articulated in the Reform Act. So I think D-List provides a great sort of foundation for how we're going to be building off of it and moving forward.
It may also be completely possible that on the other side of this project, there's data that could in turn be fed back to D-List in the sense of looking at a more refined understanding of sea level rise effects that could then feed back into D-List and help inform that prioritization going forward.
Mike, and then the judge.
Sure. Well, on that same question, the assessment is a dynamic concept. I mean, it's going to change, I assume. Are we going to get a worst case scenario? Or when we talk about next year, What is our what tools will we have to make that assessment? And is changing, I think, all the time. We don't know what's going to happen, frankly. We're trying our best to forecast what would happen, but I guess what the worst would be the more important for us in terms of decisions. Are you going to be able to do that, or how would you do that?
Sure. And this is where I think state guidance and those resources that we flew over earlier in the presentation really come into play. So things like the Ocean Protection Council's sea level rise guidance and how they suggest characterizing sea level rise risks relative to your risk tolerance based on your assets and resources. We think that'll be a very useful framework for trying to organize how we characterize the risks within the vulnerability assessment. I think OPR has also done a really great job of providing guidance to state agencies in particular of how to think about exposure and sensitivity to risk and how those relate to the different types of assets and resources that state agencies in planning or documents or programs or in projects, how to kind of interpret that. So it's a bit of a long answer, but we'll be using state guidance to help us do a good job at this.
And each of those guidance documents that Kate mentions defines a range of scenarios based on what we know now. A range of scenarios from a mild, sort of a more moderate level of sea level rise to a worst case analysis. Our analysis is going to look at multiple points along that spectrum. So we will have a worst case, but we'll also have a more moderate type of scenario. I think the other important thing for us to consider going forward is how we adaptively manage that too. Because, for example, we have today's understanding of potential climate change effects, which is different than the one we had just 2 or 3 or 5 years ago. And it'll be different still from the one that we're going to have 2 or 3 or 5 years from now. So I think we're also, as we proceed with this, looking at ways that we can adaptively manage it so that what we have is an assessment based off of the range of data available today and a mechanism to update or adjust it as we get new climate forecasts that are either more aggressive or more conservative or less conservative as we go forward.
So I take a slightly different approach than I think where this is headed, although I've heard some of this from other council members so far. And I start from three premises. Premise one is that the goals that we identify, they're not binding on the people in the Delta, and they're not binding on future councils. The second premise that I go to is that assessments have been done before, and you know, there's other groups out there doing assessments. So there's other scientists out there doing assessments. And, you know, those assessments have been out there for quite some time. I've seen some of them, and I'm sure you have as well. And premise three is that, you know, the best way, I think, to approach life in general is, you know, focus on the stuff that you can affect as opposed to the stuff that you can't affect. And we have a situation of policymakers both at the federal and state level who have a wide variety of priorities. They have a wide variety of attention spans. And so we have to really drill down, what can this government agency do? And with those three premises in mind, what I suggest is focusing on one or two or three priorities that are the most important and the ones that we should really take the lead on and that we can take the lead on and we have the capacity to take the lead on. And to really determine what this agency, the council and the staff, the executive staff, can do to actually improve things. I believe a lot of energy can be spent crafting goals, determining assessments, and we run the risk that there's really no effect. So what I would suggest is, I mean, look, if we conclude that there is, you know, you pick any of the one risks, and we conclude that the best way to make a difference is to lobby the legislature for millions and millions of dollars, or to lobby the federal government for millions and millions of dollars to focus on that risk, to put our executive officer, to put our chairwoman in front of the media to talk about this again and again and to hammer it and just let that be our one issue that we're known for, then I think we would actually make a difference. I've had experience with this, and I know you do too, that, you know, it's, you can sometimes plan for a long time, you can assess for a long time, but actually making a difference and recognizing how you can be a change agent in the world, that I think is the key thing that we're trying to develop. Thanks.
Maria.
Yes. My questions or comment that I have is complementary to what was said. I understand the goal setting, and then I understand the process of trying to do the adaptation, or, you know, and it's important to see that there got to be not only, you know, I agree that it has to be focused on one thing, but there's also such a concurrent parallel efforts. And the dilemma is that you move with the best information you have, but you don't have the full picture. But it's important to move because these things happen in the long term. So what I think that the role of the council would be, maybe, or I would like to see that we are brought in to talk about what Mike Caro said on what is the focus, but also what is the level of effort at a given time while we are already finding out. But then we have to do something about it because we can't wait here and do scientific studies after studies and be patient because this change is going to be very slow in order to know what we have to do. Mm-hmm. And I find this in other places that there's too much studying of something, and by the time you bring crisis to it, that everybody's watching you, that you got to do something about it, takes a very long time. And that is not good. And I think our role would be to bring a crisis to it of what the important issues are, and it's now, whatever that timeline is, versus studying it for a longer period of time. And it is a battle, and it is a challenge, because we don't have a full picture. We know what we know, and how do we make the best decisions with what we know at that time, yet call resources on it, call attention, because when does something get done? When you bring crisis to it. And the timing of it is on people like us, of when is that you come out and you say, it's a parallel effort. It's not one and then the other. So that's something, not that I know the answers, but it's something that concerns me, and I think we should discuss it while the studies are being done and have implementations. And of course, I mean, these implementations are also going to cost money, and, you know, how do we bring resources to get it done? And in a way, all of it would be some kind of a strategy that I think people like us here should address all the time.
Ken.
Yeah, I mean, well said by Council Member Gatto and Council Member Maranian, because I've, you know, trying to synthesize all this, you know, it really is, I think, what's the highest value of doing this, you know, vulnerability assessment and the adaptation strategies? And I guess I'm kind of at this basic level. I think, you know, I'm glad Mike brought up that we got to focus, you know, on not everything, and that gets back to, you know, who is the audience for this? I mean, Jeff, you said this could be a Delta Plan amendment, which makes it pretty broad audience and potential covered actions and all of that. But I mean, we're going to put information out, and maybe that's kind of what I'm hearing also is you know, what is the highest value, just putting information out? Or is it, you know, are we asking local governments in the Delta to implement, you know, show them here's your vulnerabilities and here's these adaptation strategies, and, you know, go forth and adapt. I mean, those are kind of things I think we need to understand, because, you know, like Maria said, it's going to cost money. So we can put a, you know, what I had a thought of, gee, okay, are we going to evaluate the adaptation strategies as to cost effectiveness or, you know, funding? I mean, we could put all sorts of stuff out there, but who's going to implement it? You know, is the water contractors going to implement it? Is the local governments going to implement it? You know, I think that's a important part, and really defining. And, you know, I don't think you can argue with any of the goals. I mean, we don't have, I mean, this is like, yeah, sure. We don't have the vulnerability assessment done, so we don't know, hey, you know, how, where we should prioritize. But it, you know, it's what do we want to accomplish? And I think you're hearing is we should be focused on what can we do, and you know, I think we've brought this up before, is, you know, we've got this role of information and science and data, but what's our role as an advocate? How do we use the Delta plan? How do we use the information we're producing to advocate for something? And what is it that we want to advocate? Which I think, Mike, gets to your point of prioritizing and focusing on fewer things. So I think for at least for me, I think I'm at this kind of level of what are we trying to get done? Who do we want to do it? And, gee, how's it going to get paid for? And what do they think? If we're putting the burden on local government, then I didn't see any local government people on the tack. You know, and I know we're outreaching to them, but, you know, it's sort of like, well, I want you to do these things, then they need to be a much more integrated part in the planning effort.
Mike.
Yeah, and just to put a finer point on it, you know, you two and your team have done a tremendous job. I mean, this is fantastic stuff here. And I want to make sure that policymakers out there see this and they understand it, and that we can distill it down into something that's understandable and that it leads to action. You know, they say in life, you know, do one thing, do it well. And Ken reminded me of this, you know, when in his comments. And then, you know, I realize there's a lot to do, but I think that, you know, we do run a risk of, if some of this stuff leads to, all right, let me back up a little bit. Another principle that I come from, or that I come to this analysis with, is that nothing in government moves fast, and nothing in the Delta moves fast. And this is something that, as Maria said, is sort of a crisis, right? And we have an opportunity to determine what we in this room can actually do to affect it. You know, if this becomes something that makes its way into a plan amendment and gets sued on, and, you know, we'll still be talking about this 12 years from now. So I will just say that I am in favor of doing something that, you know, we pick two or three things that are media worthy, that are where there's probably interest at the federal level, at the state level, and at the local level, and we start being a leader on it, because we should be the leader on it. And I think the Delta, and I think this particular state agency, deserve nothing less than us being a leader on it. Thanks.
One more, yeah. I have just if to synthesize, as we said, all this in my mind, it's like, we have to narrow this down of what are we going to do, how, when, and how we're going to pay for it. It's like four questions that needs to be answered among all the research and all the findings that we will have, which then leads you to some kind of an action plan and a strategy.
Right. So what I'm observing is that we have a timing question before us, as well as the desire to have the council be more of an advocate. And I'm also observing that we are conflating a few things. So one of the roles of the council is that it develops a long-term comprehensive management plan for the Delta. So we have a long-term responsibility, And for that long-term planning, we need something like a climate vulnerability assessment for the Delta, which right now does not exist. There is not a comprehensive assessment of the impacts of various climate scenarios on the Delta. We need this information. We need it to be done thoroughly. We need to get to the climate adaptation strategies. But we cannot do that until we've completed homework, and we've heard from the staff that they will be including the community and stakeholders in addition to the Technical Advisory Committee. Now, contrast that with the visibility of the council and the oversight role and the wish to know what to do when to complete something that is very different than our long-term comprehensive management planning role. And the Delta plan is to guide stewardship in the Delta. So how do we reconcile that we are to be providing the best available science, unbiased science, that informs this long-term comprehensive management plan that not only affects water, but also affects land use in the Delta. That is very separate from, yes, climate change is happening now, and we ought to be focusing on one or two projects that the council can highlight in the present day. I don't know how to reconcile those two things right now. We have the long-term comprehensive management planning role, but we also have the coordination role with our sister agencies. Some of those sister agencies have already been quite visible on climate change: Office of Planning and Research, the California Natural Resources Agency, the Department of Water Resources has at least a decade of climate change studies related to the State Water Project. And I think part of the effort here is to take an inventory of all that and then apply it very specifically, downscale that information to the Delta. The different question of, okay, let's pick one or two or three things that the council itself can do. I don't know the answer to that question, and that's very separate from this vulnerability assessment. So I think, I don't know that we have the time to go through all the resilience goals, but I think we do owe it to the staff to give them some sort of feedback on the goals for the assessment. Since we approved the contract in May of 2018, we have a technical advisory committee formed, and we obviously have some community Delta interests who would like to have a say in how this assessment is conducted and on the goals. So I invite the council, not necessarily at this meeting, but at future meetings, to get a little more specific on how we separate our long-term responsibility and the idea that we're going to complete this assessment with choosing one or two or three items that we need to go out and do. I don't know what those items are. If you have some actions in mind, but I think those actions are separate from an assessment.
If you could shed light on something that you said, I just don't see why we can't have a process of long-term things and then goals and strategies, and meanwhile, what comes out of this long-term, that could be some steps that are taken not only on focusing on issue, but also the timing of it. So I'm trying to see there is no probably contradiction between having the long goal and having the long process, but meanwhile having findings of step by step that has action items that translate into focus on one issue in a certain period of time or two issues. So I'm saying one comes out of the other, but if we think of even methodology or philosophically, I don't understand why one contradicts the other.
Well, I don't think I'm saying that one contradicts the other. And maybe, Maria, I'm not understanding. Are you saying that you would like to have specific actions for the assessment itself, or
no? I'm not saying what you specifically said. I'm not saying that. I'm saying if the Delta Stewardship Council has the stewardship and has the long-term goal of protecting the co-equal goals and all that, can't it also have specific short-term goals that says, now do this because it is really imperative between now and the next 2 years?
Yeah. And absolutely, that's what's in the Delta Plan now, too. I mean, the Delta Plan, while it considers the long-term, we certainly have near-term actions.
Exactly.
We're not limited to what comes out of this has to be a Delta Plan amendment, has to go through the whole process of doing that. Mm-hmm. It could be a white paper that we use for advocacy. It could be, it likely will be short-term goals, medium-term goals, and long-term goals. Right. So I think there's a way to reconcile all this feedback. And I absolutely think that focusing on what we can control is excellent advice.
Thank you. I think we're good.
Yeah, you know, not to keep this, you know, not to belabor this, but it seems like one question is the scope of the assessment and the adaptation strategy, and Madam Chair, you're saying that we need to do this comprehensive, however that is, scope of impacts, vulnerabilities, and adaptation for the Delta. And, you know, I think the question that's coming up, and I know the question in my mind, is what's the highest value of this effort? Is it just the assessment and the strategies, or I think what you're hearing, and I think the way you talked about it, you reconciled it, is okay, is there value in us taking the results of this work and doing something with it and saying, gee, these seem to be high priorities, we can do something with this, and let's do that, whether it's focusing on working with state agencies or local governments. I mean, that's I think for the council, I don't know if I think I'm speaking for more than myself, it's like, we need to think about how do we want to use this. And if it's just we've got to do this and put it on the shelf, I don't know. I don't know that we're in agreement that that's the highest and best use
We're not going to do that. We're not going to put it on a shelf.
Okay,
I think it's like anything we do where some of it may inform, okay, well, maybe we want to amend some of this guidance into our regulation so it's a requirement for state and local actions. That could be an outcome from an adaptation strategy. Or maybe it's a recommendation to a regulatory agency that they should do the same or that they should take certain actions. Hopefully, it would also be information that is usable by local governments in their planning documents so that the things that they have control over and that they have funding for, they can move forward on, and they're part of developing those strategies. So I think it's early to have this discussion, but I think we wanted to at least check in on it. But first is the assessment, and then is the adaptation strategy. But knowing, you know, already the feedback I'm hearing around the table is very helpful in how we pursue phase one, so that we get to a usable and actionable phase two.
Because I'm hearing from the chair is that, you know, we need to do a broad scope here to do, if I'm hearing you correctly, that we need to do this full assessment and be able to have that information available. And what we do with it is sort of, you know, but I think we need to know that there's that, you know, is there value in how we're approaching this? What is this the highest value? Is there, you know, can we focus the scope to be more results oriented? I don't know. I mean, my only comment on the resilience goals is how do you argue with them? I think, hey, if staff thinks this is where we should go and they've talked to the stakeholders, it's like, I don't have enough information to say you're missing something. Not until we see the assessment. And then it's really, you know, tell us what's the most important thing we can do. How can we use this plan effectively and really add value like Mike's saying, in leading the discussion.
Mm-hmm. So one thing I'd like to clarify is I was not meaning to say that it's an either or a zero-sum game. We certainly can do what Maria and Mike are asking. I was meaning to say that the assessment is separate from taking those more immediate near-term actions. And Jeff,
did you get input?
Yeah, I might just add as well that, you know, there's a transition point that will occur between, we had the two phases of the study. There's the vulnerability assessment, which is meant to cast a very broad net and look at the range of assets and exposures that are out there. But as we move from the vulnerability assessment to the adaptation strategy, is a perfect place to begin to narrow that focus.
Yes.
And to say, of the range of resources out there, of the level of exposure that's there, the really critical points are in these three or four places. Then we harness that energy and push in the adaptation strategy with focus on the three or four areas where there's greatest risk, or three or four areas where there's a matchup between great risk and the council's ability to affect that change, is I think kind of what I'm hearing in this dialogue, is a desire to make that focus, but to ensure that it's put in the right place. Mm-hmm. And I think if we're able to kind of proceed with this more broad analysis between now and October, we come back in the fall of this year with results from that assessment and a staff-level sense of priority, we have that discussion with the council about those priorities.
And I might add that it's not a reinventing of the climate science wheel. It's really looking at what's out there and then figuring out, okay, well, what does that mean on the ground or in the water on the Delta? So that it's not meant to be a new endless study. It's really meant to take advantage of the research that's out there and apply it directly to our mission.
And I think we can also, you know, as we're conducting the assessment, eyes wide open to immediate opportunities. I mean, if there are things that we discover along the way where there is resource, this is a place where the council can weigh in early and take action, we would certainly bring those to your attention.
Thank you, Jeff. Randy.
To answer your question specifically, I think the resilience goals are fine. I would just add what I mentioned earlier, that whatever impacts we determine sea level rise will have on Delta levees and how that will vary from region to region, I'd like to see that incorporated with an eye towards informing the database that we now use as the decision support tool.
Mm-hmm. Oscar.
So I would concur. I think the goals make a lot of sense. In fact, under the fifth goal, governance, the final bullet there really sort of underscores in large part preserving this council's ability to sort of further refine the adaptation responses, whether we identify a series of buckets and we put sort of long-term, large-scale, very expensive ones in one bucket, and we put short-term, very achievable, certainly within our scope, strategies in front of us to say these are the ones we want to tackle. I mean, I think we're preserving our right to do that as part of the goals that you've laid out for us under the governance topic. The other point I really want to underscore, and I think you have identified it, but the notion of local input and participating not only at the sort of the granular level, at the local input, I mean, tremendous benefit in walking out to a site, talking to a farmer who's farmed land for multiple generations to say, tell me about your experience as it relates to vulnerability as we talk about climate change. It's amazing what you'll learn rather than trying to have them come to a Tuesday night meeting where, you know, you've noticed it and they're just trying to farm and it's now, you know, the worst time of the year to try to get them to show up at a meeting. But actually go out to their site. They'll tell you about what their experience, what their great-grandfathers experienced and down the line. So I think at that granular level, you're going to get a lot of information as it relates to vulnerability. The sister agency participation, this is something that I think we could really benefit by ensuring that we really make sure that
the sister agencies are hearing, understanding, participating in, and being a part of the conversation, because the last thing you want with something like this is right at the end of the process, folks start coming forward to say, we didn't know, we weren't told, we were never asked. It just really undermines the integrity of doing the outreach. So I would just sort of underscore that as well.
Great. Thank you, Oscar. Anything else? So I have one question on page 2 under phase 2 adaptation strategy paragraph. It says, for each recommended strategy, the project will include a general assessment of costs, benefits, governance, and opportunities for council action and leadership. That sounds really big. Maybe that's for each recommended...
You were general.
doesn't have to be answered now, but I'm just wondering level of detail on cost, benefits, governance, and items for each strategy.
It is intended to be general. I do think to the degree that we're able to bring more focus to the range of activities that we pursue, that may afford the ability to go a little deeper on some of those items. Like if we're not looking at a full spectrum of activities, but rather a very focused set, it could afford us the ability to go a little deeper on some of those perspectives. To the degree that we're looking at a wider range of solutions, necessarily I think we'd be looking at a lower level of detail on those items.
That would be phase 3 of the project, probably.
Madam Chair, would
Judge.
This be an excellent starting point for the next implementation committee agenda? So you have the federal and the state agencies and a number of folks. Oh, it seemed to me it'd be a very good time to be moving.
We're certainly engaging those folks as we move forward with the stakeholder group and the technical advisory committee. I think when the time is right, then we'll certainly be presenting this information at a DPIC meeting. Maybe just one more final comment, which is that I don't want us to think about this activity in a vacuum, because the reality is that in implementing the Delta Levee Investment Strategy as a prime example, we're already looking at how sea level rise affects risk in the Delta. We've already made recommendations about which levees should be prioritized for state funding as a result of that risk, and we're looking at it in the ecosystem amendment. So we're not waiting for the outcome of this particular study. This is really, I think, to give us a broader picture and to make sure that we're not missing anything and that we can reprioritize once we have additional information. But it shouldn't be seen in a vacuum, because we are already acting on that information now in the amendments we're making to the Delta Plan and in the actions we're engaging with annually.
Okay, I have one public comment. Are there other comments from the public on this item? No? So just for the record, we have Daniel Whaley and Doris Whaley. Are they here?
No.
No. Okay. We have a written submission from them asking us to examine or the basis of climate change as a false scenario, and we have a article attached, Top 10 Global Warming Lies That May Shock You, by James Taylor, in Energy and Environment.
I think we can just circulate that to members.
Yeah, I wasn't planning on reading it. So are there any public comments in general on any other council items? Okay. Well, then, our next council meeting will be March 21 at 110 West Fremont in Stockton, California. Looking forward to seeing you all there. And that adjourns this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you.